Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Peer-to-Peer, International Idea's podcast series on elections, hosted by me, Erik Asplund.
And me, Heidi Park. Together, we speak with practitioners and academics from around the world to share knowledge, experience, and good practice, with a special focus on the impact of natural hazards on electoral processes.
Today, we're joined by David Towers and Atsuku Hirakawa to discuss Haiti's 2010 election and how it grappled with an earthquake, a hurricane, and a cholera outbreak.
And with its geographic location in the path of Atlantic hurricanes and its steep topography, this makes Haiti particularly vulnerable to hydrometeorological disasters. And to add further, due to the high deforestation rates, the country is dangerously exposed to floods and landslides. It's also one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere, which has left its infrastructure severely vulnerable against any crisis, such as natural hazards. In 2008, Haiti was struck by four hurricanes and tropical storms, which killed almost 800 people and devastated many of its infrastructure.
In January 2010, Haiti was struck by a Richter scale 7 earthquake. The earthquake killed an estimate of 250,000 people and displaced 1.5 million people. While the legislative election was to be held in February and March 2010, this was postponed in order to recover from the earthquake. Just days before Election Day, Hurricane Thomas made landfall in Haiti whilst the cholera outbreak was unfolding. Welcome, David and Atsuku. We're so excited to have you on the show. Could you just briefly introduce yourselves to our listeners? For some older listeners, they may recognize David.
Thank you, Erik and Heidi. It's wonderful to be back. I'm David. So I'm currently the associate, or one of the associate program officers within the democracy assessment team. Prior to that position, I worked with the electoral processes team with you, Erik, and had the great fortune of working on the first series of this season of this excellent podcast. And it's wonderful to be with Atsuku, a colleague with a deep knowledge and affection for Haiti. So, yeah.
Thanks, David. Atsuku.
Thank you, Erik and Heidi. I'm also delighted to join you today with my colleague, David. I'm Atsuko. I'm also part of the Democracy Assessment Unit as Program Officer and Coordinator of the Democracy Tracker, which is a new online tool that provides monthly qualitative data on the state of democracy in 173 countries, which we just launched together with the Global State of Democracy 2022 report. Before this position, I was part of IDEA's program in Myanmar until it was suspended due to the military coup. Prior to joining IDEA, I worked with UNDP and other UN agencies, primarily in the area of democratic governance and electoral assistance, in different parts of the world, including in Haiti, which is indeed a country with complex challenges, but also a very special place.
Thank you, Atsuku. You know, I was recently at the Declaration of Principles for International Election Observation in Brussels. It was hosted by the European Parliament and the EU External Action Service. And it was lovely because both Pietro Ducci, the Director General for External Policies, and also the former President of Costa Rica, Laura Chinchilla, both mentioned the IDEA Global State of Democracy report and the fact that, pointing to democratic backsliding in various regions. And they made this point in their opening remarks. So it's great that the report is making waves, so to speak.
Thank you so much.
Indeed. So for our listeners who are interested, you can find the new Global State of Democracy report linked in our background reading section. So thank you both for joining us today. As mentioned, our main focus today is on Haiti and more specifically the 2010 elections. So to start off, let's give our listeners a little bit of context about Haiti. So the country has had a very tumultuous political, social, and economic history, which has certainly had an effect on modern-day Haiti. So Atsuko, could you briefly explain their historical and political context?
Sure. Haiti's history is extremely complex and rich, but I'll try to provide a very short overview as a background for our discussion today. Haiti gained independence in 1804. It is the world's first state to be formed through a slave revolt and to permanently abolish slavery. Despite its independence, Haiti's history is marked by turbulence, including foreign occupation, dictatorship, and natural disasters, which, along with the colonial rule, have certainly contributed to impeding Haiti's development and continue to impact modern-day Haiti. Since the fall of the Duvalier regime in 1986 and the adoption of a new constitution that promoted democratic values such as direct universal suffrage, press freedom, and decentralization of powers, efforts to build democracy have been overwhelmed, with the following decades marred by coups, violence, foreign military interventions, and humanitarian crisis. The rebellion that rose in 2004 led to the deployment of a UN peacekeeping mission, which lasted for 13 years. And the earthquake that struck Haiti in 2010 brought devastating impacts to the country's political and socioeconomic trajectory once again, including on the electoral process.
Thank you so much. And you've had experience working and living there. Could you just walk us through your experiences living there?
Of course. I worked with UNDP's office in Port-au-Prince between 2011 and 17. When I arrived, the aftermath of the earthquake was still vivid, with the city covered with debris and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. My first year focused on supporting the post-earthquake recovery process, specifically in setting up a unit responsible for coordinating the construction of housing and public buildings within the Prime Minister's office. In 2013, I joined UNDP's project to support the electoral cycle. We began by supporting what was then called the Transitional College of the Permanent Electoral Council and later Provisional Electoral Council, as well as the National Identification Office. Because of the volatile political context, frequent change of the CEP, electoral calendars with extremely short timeframes, and repeated postponements of the elections, supporting the electoral process in Haiti was extremely challenging. For example, January 2016 presidential runoff was postponed due to the escalation of violence and then cancelled, and the October 2016 retake of the presidential election was postponed due to the passage of Hurricane Matthew. But despite the difficulties, my experience was also rewarding and inspiring, seeing the country recover from the earthquake over the years and being part of an effort to build democracy.
So moving on to the case study and the elections in 2010. Before the earthquake, Haiti had planned to hold its elections in February and March. David, could you briefly talk us through the electoral process and what was at stake during these elections? And who the main actors are in implementing elections in Haiti?
Absolutely. Thank you, Eric. Let me tackle the elections first. So in your introduction, you referred to the legislative elections that were due to be held in February and March. And these were to be held for seats in both the upper and the lower chambers of Haiti's parliament. So all of the seats of the lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, were going to be contested, and one third of the seats in the upper house, the Senate. So there was a good percentage of the seats were up for grabs. Also relevant is the fact that all of those seats were due to expire in May. And that there was no constitutional provision for the extension of those terms. So there was very little flexibility in terms of the timing, which was to sort of have significant consequences later in sort of in constraining the ability of the election commission and others to act. But then there was also a presidential election due in November. And again, the sort of constitution was quite prescriptive there. So the wording is that it had to take place on the last Sunday of November in the fifth year of the president's term, which in 2010 was the 28th of November. So very little wiggle room there too. let's address the actors involved. So the sort of principal actor is the EMB, the Provisional Electoral Council. And they had a broad remit with responsibility for the organisation and the oversight of all election operations. And they also had responsibility for hearing and deciding electoral disputes. Now, this is important to our future sort of discussions about sort of trust. But in carrying out their mandate, they had to work alongside national authorities. And the most sort of relevant, I think, to our discussions is the National Identification Office, which had responsibility for maintaining the civil registry, whose data was then used for compiling the voter registry. And they also had responsibility for issuing the national identity cards. And this is important because they were the only accepted form of voter ID and they were a mandatory part of the polling process. A third type of actor I think that is relevant are the electoral assistance providers. So there was considerable involvement from international organisations, including non-governmental organisations and intergovernmental organisations, which were providing a range of electoral assistance. So it conventional assistance, such as help with the registration process, but it also included electoral security, which came from the UN.
Thank you for that, David. Also, I remember when I was reading your case study that you mentioned that the UN also had a role or in providing security. I was thinking about election security primarily. Is that correct?
Yes. As Atsuko mentioned in her earlier response, the UN had had a peacekeeping presence in the country since 2004 under the minister, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti. And that was reinforced prior to the election with police, additional sort of police officers and military personnel. And they provided a security during the campaign period for hustings and debates, but also they provided security during on election day at polling stations.
Great. Thank you so much, David, for that background information. I think it'll be very helpful for our listeners as we move forward. So what would you say were the main challenges in implementing the elections this particular year? So challenges that were created because of the triple crisis and challenges that were exacerbated by these crises.
Thank you, Heidi. I think that's a really good question. And it's important to state that there were these sort of pre-existing challenges and that they were being exacerbated by the impact of the three natural hazards that Haiti experienced in the lead-up to that election. So even before the earthquake in January hit Haiti, the country was facing long-term sort of social and institutional problems that severely impeded electoral administration. But let's start with those long-term problems in relation to trust. Okay, so trust in the electoral commission. So it was envisioned by the 1987 constitution as a transitional body, but repeatedly it had its mandate extended. And then in the immediate run-up to the election, so in 2009, it was sort of reconstituted, but it was still regarded as partisan. So those were the two sort of negative factors in shaping that low level of trust. Now, of course, when the the earthquake hit, it significantly diminished its capacity to administer elections. So its headquarters in Port-au-Prince was severely damaged, and some of its staff were killed. And so when it came to when, as inevitably happens in natural hazard affected elections, there are technical problems that arise and dysfunction may follow. That dysfunction is often quickly or can be quickly interpreted by voters as evidence of electoral fraud when trust is low. And as a consequence, it can increase the risk of violence. And in the case of the 2010 elections, it also may have played a part in the low voter turnout. So it was just 23% in 2010. So the first challenge is low trust in the Election Commission. The second challenge was production and distribution of identity cards. I mentioned in my response to your earlier question that voter ID is mandatory, and there was a specific form of national voter ID, which was the only accepted form. Several thousand of those ID cards were destroyed in the earthquake. But in addition to that, you had a considerably larger number of voters, first-time voters, who needed to receive voter ID cards for the first time. So in total, there were 400,000 ID cards that needed to be issued. And one of the biggest challenges that the state faced was the distribution of those cards. And so by the time of the election, there were still boxes and boxes of undistributed cards. Now, of course, because it's mandatory, you effectively disenfranchised all of those voters. And that was really problematic, of course. The third challenge is sort of the updating of the voters' roll. And there were two parts to that. The first was cleansing it of the deceased voters. You mentioned in your introduction 250,000 voters were killed in the earthquake. It was quickly established that it wasn't possible to cleanse those voters from it from the list, because the process for doing that was very antiquated. It was slow. It required the issuance of a death certificate before they could be taken off. So a decision was taken that they wouldn't even attempt that, and so what they would do instead was introduce sort of or rely upon other sort of security measures to protect the integrity of the election. And one of those was the use of voter ID cards. Now, the second part to the sort of updating of the voters' roll was to try to sort of ensure that those displaced voters, 1.5 million, as you mentioned in your introduction, would have access to a polling station. And they were given the opportunity by the Haitian authorities to change their polling station if they wanted to. The key problem that they had was communicating that process to voters, and then so that they knew how to go about requesting a change in polling station. And then the second problem was communicating the changes that resulted from that. So which voters had been sort of reassigned. One of the problems that they faced was that the communication was hindered by a very limited sort of voter education campaign, and whilst they had established a call centre in which voters could ascertain which station they had been assigned to, it was operational for a very short period of time. So it created a huge amount of confusion because many voters turned up to the wrong polling station. That also turned out to be a considerable challenge. So those are the three challenges that I would pick out.
David, when you were talking about the challenges, we didn't really have a chance to talk much about what was happening on polling day. One of the things I did notice when reading the paper was the fact that, you know, there was a cholera outbreak, and as a result, there were health and safety measures put into place in polling stations on EJ, sanitizers, for example. Interesting, because these were, you know, measures that were also introduced more recently with COVID in polling stations around the world. I was thinking it would be interesting to hear from you. Do you know of, was there some kind of cooperation or interagency cooperation with health agencies?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not sure about the sort of degree of interagency sort of cooperation at a sort of national level. But as you rightly say, public health messaging played a really important part in the sort of election campaign as the sort of crisis escalated. And the assistance was provided by the sort of Pan American Health Organization, which helped to create posters, which were intended to kind of reassure voters, as well as to set out the sort of sanitization sort of processes that were required to ensure that the election was able to take place in a sort of safe environment. This was important because there was considerable sort of concern amongst voters about how the disease spread. It was new to Haiti. And in fact, there was also concern amongst electoral authorities and amongst candidates, several of whom called for the postponement of the election very shortly sort of before election day. In the end, it didn't happen because health authorities and external authorities found that it could be conducted safely. But yeah, towards the end of the campaign, it played a prominent role.
Yeah, around 10 candidates were kind of pushing for a postponement.
Indeed, indeed.
Correctly.
Thank you so much, David. I think your first point on the low trust in the Electoral Commission has a very much of a trickle-down effect in the fact that, for example, it was difficult to have polling stations ready for voters, and the voters' registration potentially having an impact on electoral integrity. And just the fact that after the earthquake, there is a reduced capacity just to implement these elections despite the postponement.
Right, and I was also thinking about kind of, you mentioned the lack of trust in the Election Commission, but in the general lack of trust in government institutions before the earthquake, but also, you know, as a result of, you know, the cholera outbreak. And one thing I did notice in your paper was there was some finger pointing, and there was also some evidence that the cholera outbreak was a result of the UN mission, and I was thinking, well, you know, this mission also provided, you know, you mentioned the security, the election security, and this also had an impact. So you have various stakeholders. You have the Election Commission, where there was a low level of trust, and I'm thinking maybe even the UN mission that provided election security, there was also the trust wasn't really there, so that obviously had a impact, a general impact on the outcome.
Absolutely, and I think that, of course, whilst we don't have data on the levels of trust in Haiti in 2010, I think it was certainly not just the sort of Election Commission that in which there was sort of low trust. And again, I think in relation to the sort of cholera outbreak and the connection with UN peacekeepers, which was subsequently sort of established in research and sort of recognized by the UN itself, that issue was exacerbated again by communication failures. So the UN responded to those sort of accusations and those perceptions, which were widely held amongst sort of Haitians, in a rather sort of dismissive manner, and it was also sort of slow. So yeah, I think those points that we made in relation to the Election Commission can be made sort of more broadly. But I wonder whether at Atsuko, your experiences in Haiti also, where there were parallels with your experiences later in Haiti.
Absolutely, David. As you know, in 2016, Haiti was hit by Hurricane Matthew of Category 5, 6 days before the planned polls, which concerned the first round to elect the president following the cancellation of results from the 2015 elections, as well as to complement the second round of the election of the Chamber of Deputies, first round to elect a third of the Senate and the retake for the municipal council of one of the communes. Hurricane Matthew destroyed the southern region of Haiti, displacing thousands and resulting in the death of nearly 500 people, while numerous buildings that were destined to become polling centers were destroyed or became inaccessible. So the CEP decided to postpone the elections. But following consultations with the government, political parties, and other stakeholders, the CEP announced a modified calendar to hold the elections the following month on the 20th of November, and on the 29th of January in 2017. Since the term of the former president, Michel Martelly, had expired in February 2016, and as Haiti was under a transitional government, these elections were important for the country to restore constitutional order. The CEP carried out an assessment in the hurricane-affected region and acquired over 1,000 tents in urgence to substitute polling centers. The National Identification Office, on their part, launched a call for persons who had lost their ID cards. Around 2,000 requests were made from the four most affected departments, Grand Anse, South, NIPS, and Southeast. For both the November and January elections, civil society organizations also supported the CEP to encourage voters in the affected region through sensitization campaigns. Despite serious concerns, the polls took place in acceptable conditions, although with very low participation rates, which is a trend Haiti has suffered for many years, as David, you also noted. Still, I think it's important to note that with these elections, Haiti overcame a long electoral crisis, and with the reinstatement of the presidency, parliament, as well as municipal and local councils, Haiti was able to restore constitutional order.
David, the 2010 presidential and legislative elections, just hearing from you and Atsuko, it seems like almost like the perfect storm, right? Many things went wrong, but also there were a lot of lessons to be learned here. And sometimes I'm always thinking about, you know, building back better. What were some of the lessons that you were able to identify, which would be interesting for other election commissions that are faced with similar problems?
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I agree. Haiti, in many regards, or the Haitian 2010 elections were exceptional, but there are general lessons, I think, for to be learned from it. The first relates to the timing of elections. I think it's important that countries that are vulnerable to natural hazards take into account the patterns of these phenomena, and this is particularly important where the country has enshrined the election date in their constitution, and it doesn't offer much sort of flexibility. So ensuring that they sort of fall outside of, let's say, hurricane season is really important. The second general lesson that I can see here is that where natural hazards result in fatalities, efficiently purging the voters' roll of deceased voters is important to the perceived integrity of the election. Thirdly, in countries with strict voter ID requirements, a failure to replace voter ID or to loosen those requirements can lead to the disenfranchisement of voters. Fourth, natural hazards may necessitate significant changes to electoral processes. Communicating those to the election, the electorate, is essential to the functioning of the voting process, but also to voter trust, which we've already established is essential. And finally, how voters interpret dysfunctions is strongly shaped by their confidence in election in electoral administration. Where voter trust is low, it can increase the risk of violence.
Thanks, David. Atsuko, do you have anything to add?
Sure. On David's point on the lack of trust in the election administration, I think another lesson is to ensure timely publication of results, which otherwise can create suspicion by voters and stakeholders. The CEP during the 2016-17 elections made particular efforts to publish the results in a shorter time frame through technical innovations. But I would also point to the lack of trust and interest in the overall electoral process, which are linked to several aspects. One of them is the lack of trust in political leaders to take actions that will improve people's lives, whoever is elected. Second, the frequency of the electoral cycle in Haiti, with elections scheduled to take place every 2 years, and the persistent electoral crisis. Third, elections being associated with violence, which discouraged voters. And finally, the perceived interference by the international community, among others. So all of these issues would need to be tackled to be able to build trust. Taking a broader view, an important lesson is also that the push for democracy has to come from within the country rather than from outside. And while elections are integral to building democracy, it can't be sustained without addressing systemic issues such as corruption, impunity, poverty, and inequality. So I think it's really important that we continue to work to build strong institutions that are accountable to the citizens and support efforts of civil society actors who can often be instrumental.
No, thank you so much, Atsuko and David, for your comments on the lessons learned, and especially Atsuko, your final comment on just the need for democracy to come from within and the need for structures and different factors to kind of really push for democracy. So now we'll move on to our final segment of this episode, where we try to finish off our episode with a more reflective and personal question, which is, what has been the most important lesson you've learned over your career?
Thanks, Heidi. So I haven't been working on elections and democracy for long. I trained as a human rights lawyer. But the most important lesson I've learned from my somewhat circuitous career is follow your heart. Embrace the opportunities that present themselves, even if they take you off the path you had initially envisioned for yourself.
The most important lesson that I've learned is, as practitioners in this field, we really need to believe in our mission and keep going, as David says. I say this from witnessing countries that had made important progress over the years, but which are now regressing because of political crisis or repression by authoritarian regimes, which is extremely discouraging. But I've also learned that even if it's difficult to bring about long-term change in a country, it is possible to make small impacts by working with committed and talented professionals on the ground. And I believe it is those people that can take the country forward. I was able to witness such determination in several places. For example, in Haiti's CP that drove the 2016-17 elections, making efforts to take ownership of the process. Or in Afghanistan's women who casted their first votes despite receiving threats from the Taliban. Or in the people of Myanmar driving the revolution today to win back democracy despite the continued atrocities by the military.
Thank you so much, Atsuko and David, for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you both on the show as today's guests. For any suggestions or recommendations, feel free to email us at elections@idea.int. My name is Erik Asplund.
And my name is Heidi Park, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.